Support the Bartholomew Town Podcast by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on Apple Podcasts.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On today's episode, I sit down with the executive editor of the Providence Journal, Alan Rosenberg. Alan Rosenberg is a veteran journalist and editor in the Southern New England market, who is currently posted as the executive editor of the region's legacy newspaper, the Providence Journal. In an era dominated by evolving consumer news, broad media, and spending habits, I was curious about Mr. Rosenberg's approach to moving the journal forward with new financial and content strategies while retaining the credibility and hard news-first approach the paper has been known to produce since its origin in 1829. We also discussed Rosenberg's backstory and productive competition with other elements of the Rhode Island media market. Enjoy new episodes of the Bartholomew Town Podcast every Tuesday and Friday. Listen on your favorite podcast app, bartholomewtown.com, or ripodcast.com. You'll find the dozens of conversations I've had with Rhode Island influencers, like Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Rhode Island Now's Hillary Levy Friedman, Representative Mike Chippendale, Newsman Dan McGowan, DBR head Liz Tanner, and many more. It's all right there for you at bartholomewtown.com. All right, without further ado, let's get to my conversation with the executive editor of the Providence Journal, Alan Rosenberg. There's a lot we could get into. I'm really curious about your own backstory and kind of journey through journalism and rising through the journal and the journal lore that you've got stacked up in your history for us. You know, so what's that all about?
Well, I've been with the paper for 41 years. Came here right out of Northwestern University after an internship in Huntington, West Virginia, at a little paper called the Herald Dispatch and the Detroit Free Press. Started off in the Greenville Bureau, covering all kinds of, you know, town councils and school committees and high school science fairs, fires, you know, everything that you cover in a small operation. And after a couple of years, there was a situation with a kid who went missing up in Burrillville, the Burrillville area, actually in Thompson, Connecticut. I stayed up all night covering that with one of our photographers, and I guess they saw something in that and brought me down to be the Providence police reporter. Which was a really interesting job. You met all kinds of people doing that. After a couple of years on the police beat, the police, we had become so well connected that I went to a promotion ceremony, and one of the police officers introduced me this is Alan Rosenberg. He's a good friend of the guy being promoted today and a good friend of the department. And I thought, huh, so should I really be a good friend of the Providence Police Department or anybody I'm covering? Maybe I'm a little too close to what I'm covering. And so I asked for a change and spent a year covering City Hall when Buddy Cianci was the mayor, which was another very interesting job.
And what year is that? Cianci won when this was happening?
Yeah, that Cianci won. That is like 1982, 83. During this period also, I first covered in the first trial and then led the team in the second trial of a guy named Klaus von Bülow, who, for those, of your listeners who, are not up on their ancient history, was a, Newport socialite. That means that his job was to go to parties with his wife, who was the utilities heiress, Martha Crawford von Bülow, Sonny von Bülow, as she was known. And one fine morning, Sonny turned up on the cold tile bathroom floor in a coma. And it was actually the second time she'd been in a coma. And the police thought that Klaus had injected her with insulin in an attempt to murder her both times. And so there was a high society trial that drew reporters from all over the world, first in Newport, where he was found guilty. And then when Alan Dershowitz handled his appeal and got him off, he was retried in Providence again with a giant crowd. And this was one of the first televised trials. This time he was found not guilty. And it was just this incredible circus that I was involved in both times.
Right.
So after all that, it seemed like it was time to become an editor and get off the street. And so I've edited our old Sunday magazine. I was the West Bay regional editor and the South County regional editor. Started the Life Beat section, which was our daily feature section for a long time. Started some other sections, Sunday Brunch and the Sunday Art section. These are former sections because you keep evolving as any publication does. Breaking news editor, both online and in the paper, managing editor, and finally, a little less than 2 years ago, executive editor.
Right. And the paper has evolved throughout my life. Of course, I remember the Evening Bulletin, my dad getting that, the two newspapers that the Providence Journal produced. And it's evolved, but it still has such an authoritative position of influence in Rhode Island and beyond. It's still a highly regarded newspaper on a daily basis. It's smaller, but the work inside, the journalism, is still hard-hitting and essential. I appreciate it from both ends. So how do we maintain that as a society now? Because it's more than just the journal. We know media is changing, but what's the next step for everyone out there listening? Obviously, you can subscribe to the paper, but what else? What's the next thing?
So first of all, don't overlook that part of it, because I think a lot of people have an attitude, and it's an attitude that we fed into for two decades, like most of the rest of the news media, that information should be free, that people shouldn't have to pay for what they need to learn. And as a result, people are less willing now to subscribe than they were in the past. And yet, we rely on that income in order to not only survive but thrive, to hire the reporters. You know, it's fine to say information should be free, but where does that information come from? It doesn't come from Facebook, where you might share your story, or Twitter or Instagram. It comes from, in our case, professional reporters, highly trained, very experienced, most of them, along with some exciting new reporters that we've hired in the last year, who need to make a living, photographers who need to make a living, editors and producers who create the stories, who do the research, who find out what's really happening and don't just rewrite press releases. But who do deep dives into information. This Sunday, Alex Kuffner, our environment writer, is kicking off a series about the impacts of climate change on the state of Rhode Island, especially impact of rising seas, talking about the hurricane barrier. And I don't want to give away our story.
Sure.
But he has spent a lot of time writing and researching this story. Our photographers and graphic artists have spent a lot of time. We have a lot of good information about just how it works, as well as what it will look like when as the waters continue to rise. That doesn't come for free. A week from Sunday, Linda Borg, who's been our education writer now for a number of years, 35-year veteran of the paper, and Madeline List, one of our newest reporters, launch a series about education in Rhode Island that we'll do all year. As we know from these recent test scores, there's a crisis in education in Rhode Island. Who's going to tell you what's really going on in the schools if the Providence Journal doesn't do it? It's not going to be from the officials, who would love to say that everything is perfect, unless they're asking for money, in which case nothing is perfect. Who's going to tell you what's really going on? It's these highly trained reporters, and you can't pay them on dreams. You can't pay them on feathers. You can't pay them on people's desire to get information for free. So I think the first thing here is, yes, I hope people will buy the newspaper on a daily basis. And when they see what we're doing, that they then will subscribe. We also, for subscribers online, have special online-only sections of the newspaper. We've just launched a daily national section that has 8 more pages every day on as part of our e-edition. We're going to, again, I don't want to give away too many of our secret plans here, but we have more sections that are coming for the e-edition.
Yep.
And so the money from subscribers is a crucial part of financing journalism in the 21st century, as a lot of the brick-and-mortar department stores and other retailers that we have relied on, dwindle. The Filene's, G. Fox, Jordan Marsh, Benny's, they're
Bradley's,
not
Bradley's, where does it go from here, right?
Ames. Right. Exactly. Ann and Hope. They're not buying huge ads from us anymore. Apex. And so that is a crucial part. We also are doing a number of other things to make money to support the journalism. So we've got a marketing division called Thrive Hive that will not only place your ad, of course, we're always glad to place your ad in the Providence Journal on providencejournal.com, but they will design your online marketing campaign, place your ad wherever it should be placed, Facebook wherever it should be placed. So we've got that kind of stream of revenue. We are running live events. We have a Critics' Choice Food Festival every year. Our All-State Banquet is about to happen. This is a high school sports banquet where Paul Pierce is going to be the big keynote speaker.
Really? That's awesome.
It is awesome. Yeah. We had David Ortiz last year.
Wow.
We do a Boomers and Seniors Life Expo in the fall, again with a major headliner. So we're running events to help pay for the journalism. We've got a new app called, it's not an app, it's a texting service called Tap On It, which if you opt into that, we'll send you coupons a couple times a week. We don't want to do it so many times that you'll be annoyed and delete the text, but restaurants, other deals that you can get, and we get a cut of that action. So we're always looking for new ways of making money. We did a photo book last year of Rhode Island memories, photos from the late 1800s through 1939. We're doing another one this year from 1940s and 1950s that we hope will also make us some money. But these also are great books. People love this book. We got great response. We sold thousands more copies than the publisher thought we were going to initially sell. The way is open for our readers to participate. Anybody, really. You don't have to be our reader. If you're listening to this broadcast, we have scanning parties in April all over the state, 10 places for you to bring in your photos. For your own treasured family heirlooms of the 40s and 50s to be possibly included in the book. Those details are on our website, pictorialbook2.rhodeisland.com, or you can search my name. I wrote a column about it. So we're looking for ways to supplement the subscriber revenue and the advertising revenue that we typically relied on, because we know that in the 21st century, you got to be smart, you got to be nimble, you've got to have new ways of making money. And while there are ads on our website, we also know that digital dimes don't add up to the kind of print dollars that we used to have. So we're trying to be clever to raise more money.
Yeah, trying to be more of a modern shop. There's a new intersection that's potentially dangerous and potentially compromising, but can also work, I think, where entertainment, news, and commercial media kind of all exist under one roof and, don't necessarily interfere with each other, but can create a dynamic that was very separated before in the past, at least in my opinion, where you knew if something was a commercial versus branded content, or if you knew something was news versus something more on the entertainment end of the spectrum. Those lines are blurred, but do you think that opens up new opportunities to explore things like your sort of take on Providence Perks or whatever, the Groupon type of of program. That kind of blends. You're getting it from a news source, the Projo, so you trust it. But at the same time, it's entering into sort of the commercial media side of things.
Yeah, we are very wary of anything that's going to dilute our brand, that's going to make people question what they see on our site. We're very careful to label anything that is advertorial. We don't want anyone to question whether something they click on at providencejournal.com or on our app is a real news story. You know, we are doing more with video. We're doing more with audio. We have podcasts of our own. You know, so we certainly are aware that the future is digital and that we need to be figuring out what that means for us and how we can expand our journalism into those spaces. But for us, it is about the journalism. It's not about entertainment. It's not about edutainment. It's about continuing the kind of work that we've done since 1829, which is to cover, as was said in the very first editorial and the very first issue of the Providence Journal, the most important and interesting stories of the day. That mission continues today, in less fussy language and with photos, but really it's the same mission to inform, and we don't want to be boring. I think we want to be entertaining in the sense that you read a story and you enjoy the writing. You think it's well written. Right. You think our video is well produced and our audio, but we don't want to step over that line. That's not us.
There's been a little bit more pay for play branded content that I've seen, at least in the last election cycle, from some blogs and things like that around Providence. Do you just kind of put the blinders on when this stuff comes out, or do you actually, you know, use some of the blogs, some of the more tabloid-esque blogs in Providence as a news as a news source, the way that you would say like an Eco-RI or something like that?
Well, we certainly stay aware of what the blogs and the other sites are doing, and there certainly are stories that we follow up on that they first write about. And at the same time, we are aware of the bias that's inherent in any advocate, any pay-for-play, any politically oriented source. They often know people because they travel in circles of activists of various kinds. And so they certainly may learn things, but we never take what they say and go, oh, I guess we better write our version. We better rewrite them.
Right.
We use that as the start of a reporting process that's designed to get to what's really going on. And sometimes it's similar to what they've reported, and sometimes it's a fair amount more complex or even 180% different.
Right.
And so we always do our own diligence and our own reporting.
Absolutely. What about on the flip side of that, the Dan McGowans out there, you know, that are just being out in the field sometimes? You know that there's peer groups and relationships between news outlets, obviously. I don't think people are sharing facts on a regular basis. But I know as a songwriter in New York, or when I'm around other songwriters, around other people, even in media right now, it really pushes me to another level to have people who are cranking out at a higher level than me, so to speak, or, you know, you're pushing each other. Do you feel that is happening in Rhode Island right now, where there's some players who are kind of bringing the game up a notch, and that helps your paper?
Yeah, I think we are fortunate to have a strong journalism scene here in Rhode Island. There certainly are good reporters who don't work for the Journal. I hope I didn't make it sound like I thought the only good reporters work for the Journal. And I don't want to get into naming names because I'll leave somebody out. Certainly the Publix Radio and Channel 12 have some very strong reporters. Channel 10 has some strong reporters. WPRO does a very professional job. And of course, each outlet is doing a different sort of thing. And that does help us to elevate our game. I think you're right. And we're also cognizant that we're not able to break every story. We'd love to break every story. But there are some other strong reporters out in the field. Where I think we have an advantage is we have a large staff compared to many of these outlets. We have a very experienced staff. And in the areas that we've chosen to really concentrate on, I think our expertise is unmatched. For instance, up at the State House, we have Kathy Gregg, who is nonpareil among State House reporters in Rhode Island. And we also have Patrick Anderson, who's up there full-time. So we have two full-time people keeping an eye on the state government. And the other outlets do have people who go up there and they cover stories and sometimes they break stories. But we're up there every day examining documents, reading meeting agendas to know what's going on that they'd rather not announce in a press release. So something like that is an area where I think we don't really face a serious competition for the depth that we bring to the report. Alex Kuffner's reports on the environment are another area. And Rhode Island is really unusual. Most newspapers today don't have an environment reporter anymore. We've chosen to maintain that beat. We think it's a crucial thing for an ocean state to have somebody who writes about the environment, and Alex does it really well. And there's nobody else in this market who's doing that sort of reporting. We've got Bill Reynolds and Mark Patinkin with unique voices as writers. We travel with the Red Sox. Bill Koch is there in Seattle tonight for opening night. We travel with the Patriots. These are things that you're not going to get unless the particular TV station you watch is affiliated with the network that showed the game, then yes, of course. But we've got people on these beats getting to know these players, writing in-depth stories that you're not going to get from other news outlets around here.
Let's kind of just pivot gears in the last 10 minutes or so. The Journal has been a longtime advocate for open records, for open government, true transparency, accountability, every other synonym you could throw into that category. Rhode Island is in an interesting place right now. There's been some back and forth with the Secretary of State on voter roll information. There's several cases right now that are pending. There's also, looking outside of Rhode Island, looking at this absurd Robert Kraft story and whether or not the video should be released because of the sunshine law in Florida. What's your take generally right now? We're obviously not Ireland or the UK. We're not, beholden to crazy libel laws here. But at the same time, is it really where we need to be in terms of transparency as a society right now?
From my perspective, we're absolutely not where we need to be. There on both the local and the federal level is a predisposition toward secrecy, despite whatever laws might say about access to public records and open meetings. Government likes to operate in the dark because it keeps people from asking uncomfortable questions. It keeps people from protesting what's going on. If they don't know what's going on, they can't protest what's going on. And this is not a question of anybody who's currently in office. On the federal level, this didn't start with Donald Trump. Barack Obama was a big, big guy for secrecy. It didn't start locally with the current governor or the current attorney general, who's just been elected, by the way, and on a promise of transparency, among other things. And we're hoping that he will follow through with that. It's endemic to government everywhere. And one of the more sobering recent studies about the effects of the diminution of newspapers has shown that where there is no local newspaper, the cost of government goes up by 30%, because politicians are free to make sweetheart deals and to run government inefficiently because there's nobody looking over their shoulder, which is why it's so crucial, just to return to an earlier point for a moment, to maintain the economic underpinnings of news organizations like ours so that we can continue to keep an eye on government. Government loves to operate in secrecy. One case that you didn't mention involved a judge locally who told the reporters gathered in her courtroom that they were not allowed to talk to my jurors.
Right, right, right.
We went to court on that and got her to change her policy, although she's still pursuing parts of this of this situation. I don't need to bore you with all the details, but we're continuing to fight that battle.
Was that Amanda Milkovitz involved in that?
That was Katie Mulvaney,
right,
who covers
right.
the courts for us.
Okay.
And the court system has spent upwards of $50,000 to hire a private lawyer to maintain its right, so-called, to run the courts as it sees fit, which means to give the public as little information as possible.
Right. And now we're seeing this latest nonsense. I know there's been some corrections, and I have to go back on Twitter, I guess, and see where we're actually at. But a courtroom with video but without audio, that was 2 days ago that came in. I don't remember which court that was coming out of. But
that's Judge Christopher Smith,
yes.
Newly named to the court. And, you know, judges in Rhode Island have the right to run their courtrooms the way they want to. Judges can exclude cameras completely. Judge Smith apparently didn't want sound recorded. That is within his rights. I don't think it serves the public well. I think the public is best served when people can see and hear what's going on in the courts. Under the rules that we have in Rhode Island, he was within his rights.
Yep. Just the way it is.
Just the way it is. And, yep. You know, the Rhode Island courts are much further down the field than the federal court, which doesn't allow cameras at all.
Right.
So, you know, these are institutions that are slow to change and that we hope over time will bend the arc towards openness, just as we hope that the moral arc of the universe continues to bend towards justice.
Sure. I couldn't agree more. Right. I mean, these are elements of English common law to an extent that are still playing themselves out. So you'd expect some old school behaviors, I guess, in terms of where we are even in 2019. My last question would be Rhode Island. It's such an interesting place. I came back here. Some people were stunned that I did come back here, as people are stunned when other people come back here after they leave. I get frustrated here a lot just because it seems like new ideas, a lot of people want them, and they'll do conferences, and everyone will talk about how great new ideas are. But then when it's time to actually develop them, it doesn't seem like anyone really knows where to begin. We're seeing the population decrease. We may lose a congressional seat, et cetera.
Well, our population hasn't actually decreased. It isn't growing while other places are.
Right. So Arizona or whatever it is.
Right.
Yes. Where does Rhode Island go from here? I mean, is it going to grow in the next 20 years in a meaningful way from an economic perspective? Do you think we can retain kids with ideas who come out of some high school, go to the University of Notre Dame? Do you think they're going to come back in droves? Is there a way to build the workforce of the future out of Rhode Island from your perspective, sitting there on Fountain Street looking out the window?
You know, those are great questions and difficult ones to answer. I know that the predisposition here has always been to do things the same way, and that is a predisposition that has served us well in some ways and will kill us in the long run if we can't change it. I think the answer really lies with the people listening to this podcast. If you demand of your leaders that they change the way they do things, that they invest in this state and its future and its kids, that they fix the public schools, which is really where I think everything has to start, then maybe there will be a good future here. If things limp along the way they are, then we've got problems.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. What's the spark for fixing public education in your mind? Does it start with expanding to, you know, pre-K through an expansion of Rhode Island Promise, which is the program that essentially you can go to CCRI for free for 2 years and transfer to RIC, maybe someday URI? Is it there, or is it more on the apprenticeship level, or I don't know where it actually starts myself.
Well, this is a subject that we'll be exploring all year in the series by Linda Borg and Madeline List starting this Sunday, and which we'll also explore in the fall in a public occurrences forum that we're going to co-sponsor with Leadership Rhode Island and the Rhode Island College. This is not a question that I think that any of us can answer sitting here. It's a question that needs a lot of information, and we're going to try to lead the way in gathering the information that's needed for that.
The intersection right there of branded content and news without trying. As always, thank you for joining in on the Bartholomew Town podcast. I'll be back with a brand new episode on Tuesday. Until then, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.